Anders, thanks for doing this.
Sure.
How long were you in Sierra Leone?
2 weeks, just under 2 weeks.
And when you first stepped off the plane or out of the cab, was it obvious that things had changed in Sierra Leone?
Absolutely. I'd never been there before, so I didn't have anything to compare it to. But as soon as we started driving around the city, we saw these banners and signs everywhere about Ebola. I mean, like in roundabouts in the middle of the city, there are these big hand-painted sheets that say "Stop Ebola" or "Ebola is real." In pretty much every store or restaurant that you go to, there's a sign that says "Wash your hands and prevent Ebola." And then they have these big jugs, like Gatorade jugs, basically, set up outside the entrances to most public places with chlorinated water and a little plastic tub beneath the jug that you rinse your hands under the stream, and then the water collects in that tub. And I mean, it's just everywhere. It's a part of daily life. And you have your temperature taken a lot of places that you go to. There are police checkpoints set up along major roads where you have to stop and get out of the car and have your temperature taken. Every time we entered our hotel, we had to have our temperature taken. So there are these constant daily reminders that this disease is sort of out there lurking.
Now, you were there during the 3-day lockdown, is that right?
Yes.
And how can you lock down an entire country?
There were a lot of people asking that same question before they did it. I was actually surprised that people complied as much as they did. They gave everyone a lot of notice. Everyone knew it was coming. They were told they had to stay, if not in their house, at least in their yard or in their neighborhood. Sierra Leone came out of a brutal civil war about 10 years ago, and it's a sort of militarized state. The army has a lot of power, it has a lot of resources, and I think people have sort of learned that they have to do what the government tells them. So, and they were told that this was the law, and anyone violating the law would be arrested. So, for the most part, people obeyed and stayed home. They stockpiled food. They did their best to get everything they needed to get through those 3 days. I know some people did struggle and went hungry. Some people probably did break the curfew, but for the most part, they enforced it.
Where are Ebola patients even being treated in Sierra Leone? I mean, are they being taken to hospitals, or where are they being treated?
Well, things have changed over the duration of the outbreak. Initially, anyone who was going sick was going to the hospital, and as a result, was sometimes spreading the disease to healthcare workers. In some cases, people who didn't have good access to a hospital or a clinic would just stay home and would often infect their caregivers, which was usually their family members. As the outbreak escalated, a lot of hospitals started closing because the staff was leaving for fear that they were going to contract this deadly disease. And then it was difficult for sick people to find anywhere to go. There were a handful of what they call Ebola treatment units set up in different parts of the country. Early in the outbreak, those were mostly in the eastern part of the country. But the beds at those facilities, which were specifically for Ebola patients, very soon filled up. And for a period of time, there were people regularly being turned away, showing up at these treatment units and being told, "We're sorry, we don't have any beds for you." And this was pretty well documented in the early days of the epidemic. People would just be literally lying on the ground outside of these treatment centers in both Sierra Leone and even more so in Liberia. Now we're at a stage where the response has scaled up somewhat. There are more Ebola treatment units scattered around the country, and I don't think that there is currently a bed shortage in Sierra Leone. I think most people, if not everyone who seeks care, is able to get admitted to one of these facilities with specialized care.
What's daily life like for those who aren't sick?
Daily life for people who aren't sick has still changed, in part because of the things I described earlier. I mean, these constant reminders that you have to watch out, you have to be careful. Their freedom in many ways is restricted. There are quarantines around the country. There are roadblocks around the country to limit movement between different villages and different regions. There is also a new culture that has evolved all across the country of not touching. And this is a big shift for people in Sierra Leone, at least according to what I was told. You don't shake hands with people. You don't hug people. You don't demonstrate physical affection towards other people. We saw that very soon after we arrived. In fact, the first person that I met when we got to our hotel, I was introduced to, and I just instinctively reached out my hand to shake hands with them. And they said, "I'm sorry, but I can't shake your hand." And then I was kind of embarrassed because I knew, of course, you're not supposed to shake hands. But it's so instinctive, you know, that the human, so many human interactions have physical contact with you know, as part of them. And it was just very strange to be in a place where if anyone even brushed up against you, you noticed it because you're not used to being touched.
In some of your reporting, you described what life is like for survivors of Ebola when they return to society. And what is life like for those who manage to survive?
It's very difficult for a number of reasons. It's very rare for just one person in a family to get sick. So for every survivor, there are usually two or three family members who have passed away. Families have been decimated. Often it's the person who makes money that has died. So there's a whole new set of economic challenges. On top of that, it's a stigmatized disease. There's still a lot of myths or misunderstandings about what causes the disease, whether or not you're still contagious after you've recovered. So often survivors go home and they're shunned, even by loved ones or friends. It's very difficult for them to reintegrate into their communities and to sort of rebuild their lives. That said, there have been some tremendous efforts by local healthcare workers, community leaders, and the government to change attitudes about survivors, to educate people, to help them understand that once you've recovered from this disease, you don't have it anymore. You're not going to give it to someone else. And to encourage people to stop discriminating against people once they have survived, you know, this awful disease. They've already been through so much. You know, please help them, welcome them back into your communities.
You described the 3-day shutdown of pretty much normal life in Sierra Leone. And was it how did the crisis affect the way that you reported? I mean, was it difficult to travel around the country, for instance?
Yes. You know, we had all the usual challenges of being on a reporting trip in Africa where, you know, there's just a lot of things you have to deal with in the absence of an outbreak like Ebola, you know, language difficulties, travel difficulties, all sorts of challenges, you know, finding the right person to talk to. And of course, meeting deadlines for stories that are being turned around in the same day. Then on top of all of that, we have to constantly worry about our own safety. I mean, we never went into an Ebola treatment unit. We never had direct contact with someone who had Ebola. We never interviewed anyone that had Ebola. So that was the first and most important precaution that we took. But even so, we had to assume some of these people might have Ebola. Some of these people that we're speaking with might have Ebola and just not know it. The chances of them giving it to us are very, very slim. But I can tell you that when you're there standing with someone and that thought is in the back of your mind, it does provoke some anxiety. And I think it's reasonable to exercise a certain amount of caution, even if it's beyond what's really needed. So that it's just an extra layer of stress and you know, something you have to constantly consider as you're doing your usual work. My producer and I sort of used what we call the buddy system. You know, I would keep an eye on him. He would keep an eye on me. If I noticed that he had touched something he maybe shouldn't have or had set his bag down in a place that he shouldn't have, I would point that out to him and make sure that he used some disinfectant spray that we had brought or these like Clorox wipes that we had brought to disinfect anything that had the remotest chance of being contaminated. So yeah, it's, you know, I never felt threatened. I never really, you know, went home at night and thought, oh my gosh, I wonder if I have Ebola. But it was just an extra degree of vigilance that we had to practice.
In September and October, Ebola dominated the news in the U.S. And I think the impression is that These Western African countries are struggling to combat the disease. Did things seem out of control when you left Sierra Leone?
Everyone I spoke to was very concerned that it would get out of control. I wouldn't say it was out of control yet, but I had a number of conversations off the record with people from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they were genuinely concerned, like more concerned than they had been about other diseases that they had worked on, because of the rate at which it was growing in those early days of the outbreak. I think their predictions may have been exaggerated. I think some of the numbers that were circulated were perhaps artificially high and unrealistic, but there was a genuine concern, and still is, that this could really get out of control and could completely destabilize these countries, that infections could get so out of control that many cases would start popping up in other countries. There was really real genuine concern. That said, you know, we are starting to see a downturn now. It varies a little bit by country, but it is not growing at the same rate that it was previously. It's unclear if the numbers coming in are totally accurate, and it's unclear why this decline has started, if in fact it has started. But I can tell you that there have been a lot of communication and messaging campaigns to educate people about Ebola, to help them understand how to protect themselves. And it may be that those education campaigns are having an effect. That together with these mammoth efforts on the parts of local health workers and also international supporters to get people into care facilities as early as possible and to trace anyone that they've had contact with.
How were you treated when you came back to the United States? Any extra precautions?
Well, we came back just before the gentleman in Dallas, Thomas Eric Duncan, the Liberian man who had flown to Dallas and then was later diagnosed with Ebola, before he had arrived and before he was in the news. And it was really his sickness and eventual death that set off a sort of national panic about Ebola, and that triggered the response of several governors to implement these sort of draconian laws and to try and forcibly quarantine returning health workers from West Africa. So we missed all of that. Our return was pretty straightforward. You know, as we left Sierra Leone, we had our temperatures taken. We had to wash our hands in chlorine solution. We had to answer a questionnaire confirming that we hadn't been exposed to anyone with Ebola. On the U.S. side, there wasn't anything that we had to do other than to take our own temperatures twice a day, which we did voluntarily. We were asked to notify someone or to notify health experts to notify a doctor if we developed any symptoms of Ebola. And we didn't come into work for a few days after we got back. We were not exposed to anyone with Ebola. We were not considered at risk at all, really, of having contracted the disease. So our limitations were quite minimal.
Do you think that there's a chance that you'll go back to do more reporting from West Africa?
Most likely. I think it depends on what happens in the coming weeks and months. We have a team of reporters that have sort of been rotating through West Africa. I'm not scheduled to go until probably early January at the earliest. It may be that by then the numbers have turned down significantly, and it may not be necessary for me to go, but it's entirely possible.
Anders, thank you for coming on.
Sure. Thank you, David.